on wings, something to dream about.
Good health and sanitation, good housing, good roads, communications, education, law and order. It sounds like a utopia these days, doesn't it? When I was growing up, we really believed it was achievable, you know?
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Suki Wessling from The Babblery. This is the second in a two-part series about Caribbean feminist Peggy Antrobus. The first episode, Our Collective Well-Being, features Peggy's thoughts on Mia Amor Motley, Prime Minister of the Caribbean nation of Barbados. Peggy is 90, and when I spoke to her in spring 2025, she had just returned home from a stay in the hospital. But if that makes it sound as if her intellectual vigor and expansive curiosity has been diminished, this episode will dispel any such notions. Talking to Peggy about the region where she has spent her life and career is like wading in the sea itself. Our conversation wove in and out of what Peggy refers to as her ongoing critique of colonialism, imperialism, and extractivism.
Third world feminism is very different from North American feminism. You know that.
Starting with this idea of a different kind of feminism, Peggy went back to the beginning, back when she thought that feminism was an American invention having nothing to do with women in her region.
So my background is really in the Caribbean, in development, and wanted to contribute some way to Caribbean development. I'm from that generation on the eve of independence, you know. So we're all fired up and wanting to contribute. So this is the reason I chose to do an economics degree. And I got a scholarship to university, to a British university. I read for economics and because I thought that would help me to contribute. My family is a family of public servants, you know, worked with the colonial office and colonial administration. So very much focused on development. When we talk about development in those days, we're always talking about socioeconomic development. Development is never about, you know, real estate. So I chose to do economics, and then I found out that that economics degree at a university in Britain did not help me understand Caribbean economies because they're based on a whole different set of theories and assumptions. Don't take account of colonial relations, right, and colonial structures. So that was the first thing I had to unlearn. Anyway, over a long, you know, trial and error in a sense. I mean, I never, apart from that decision, I never made any other decision about what I would do. I just kind of was going along. By very good luck and good fortune, I just happened to be in the right place at the right time and had the opportunities to do some things that built on each other, you know. So starting off with thinking I would be in public finance, finding out I couldn't do that, going into social work. Anyway, finally, by chance, I was asked to work on women's issues. This was the beginning of International Women's Year, which was 1975. I think International Women's Year meant something very different to people, women from the South. You know, for women like myself, it was a big thing. It was an opportunity for the first time for women from the South to be involved in these meetings in, under the auspices of the United Nations to focus on our issues. This had never happened before. And it was not only happening because of the year, but the year became a decade. So we had a decade to really get to know each other, people from Africa, Asia, the Caribbean, Latin America for the first time, opportunities to meet on a consistent basis around the UN agenda, which was also our agenda. So it was really an incredible time, and it really became my life's work.
Like many women of her generation, Peggy Antrobus developed an early suspicion of feminism based on its popular characterization. Once she understood the foundation of feminist perspective, she was able to understand how it applied to the lives of Caribbean women.
At the beginning, I didn't know much about feminism. I used to distance myself from a feminism that was about what I now characterize as North American feminism, which of course is a misrepresentation. I only found out later on that it was a misrepresentation. The representation then was white, middle-class, lesbian, man-hating, bra-burning, right? Does it sound familiar? And then I found out, no, that's not really what it's about, but it has to be denigrated like that. It has to be characterized and trivialized like that because it's really too powerful. And we can't let women get the feeling that they have all this power and that they understand the way that power structures work. That's very dangerous. So I think feminism continues to be misrepresented and also embraced. Different feminisms, not one. It's very convenient that there are different feminisms because you could always pit one set of feminists against the other. Marxist feminists and radical feminists. And anyway, the point is that my feminism has always been grounded in Caribbean history, even though I learned a lot from my North American friends. I say that because, you know, people like to say that, you know, people like myself are influenced by the North. I don't see that. I think we influence the North, at least in my own experience. I have influenced my feminist friends. We influence each other. We help each other understand that feminism is not just about patriarchy, that it's also about racism and class and colonialism.
Place is at the center of the way Peggy Antrobus expresses her political and feminist views.
You see, from the South, the world looks very different. There's a whole different perspective, a completely different perspective. I know that North Americans think that you're the center of the world, of the universe, but from where I stand, you're not. Although the influence is so pervasive, it's overwhelming.
Peggy Antrobus, in her 90 years, has developed a long view of the place the Caribbean holds in the world economy, always through the lens of a feminist from the global South. She says that in the 1970s, she and her fellow Caribbean activists were so hopeful for the development that would help their countries heal from colonialism. But few people now remember that the world economic system was not designed to help the former colonies, but rather to extract from them.
Coming out of the most recent decades since 1980, people have forgotten about that. So going into independence, that whole anti-colonial struggle, everybody understood that. And then somehow in the 1980s, not somehow, you know, with the rise of Reagan and Thatcher, all of that was lost in 1980. 84, in the Caribbean, our leaders all embraced this new so-called Washington Consensus. And in doing that, they basically abandoned what they came out of colonialism to do, which is to promote broad-based socioeconomic development in these islands that had been colonial, meaning a kind of development that prioritizes or understands that education and health and sanitation and housing are all the foundation for economic growth. An economy that's healthy for everybody, you know, in which everybody, every person has a chance to survive and thrive. And the opportunities to do that, you know, through good health and sanitation, affordable housing, good roads, communications, education, law and order. It sounds like a utopia these days, doesn't it? When I was growing up, it wasn't a utopia. It was achievable. When I was growing up, we really believed it was achievable, you know. I know it's possible. It's not utopia. It's only people are saying utopia because They never knew it. Maybe they never knew it. And I knew it. That's how I grew up. That's what inspired me.
When I met with Peggy Antrobus, we initially planned to talk mostly about Mia Mottley, Prime Minister of Barbados. Our conversation went far afield, but I wanted to include a little bit of Peggy's analysis of the Bridgetown Initiative, a proposal to reform the global financial architecture, named for Bridgetown, the capital city of Barbados.
So the Bridgetown Initiative really is a very sophisticated way of putting together issues of economy and ecology. So that Bridgetown Initiative is really visionary in that she understands the link between the climate crisis and the economic crisis and the debt crisis. It's a world financial system that is created in the aftermath of World War II. The system that we have now, which is collapsing, or which has probably collapsed. I mean, Trump has probably taken a chainsaw or a hammer or whatever to it. But that whole system was created after World War II. And America took a leading role in creating that system. The institutions were institutions like International Monetary Fund, the IMF, which is to make sure that it was possible to deal with issues of debt. So basically, if a country was in debt, the International Monetary Fund would lend the country money, which the country, of course, has to pay back. But basically, lending money to the country so that the country could pay the debt. So the beneficiary of that, of the IMF, is actually the lenders, right? Then you had the World Bank to deal with developing countries, lending money for development, a kind of a international Marshall Plan, supposedly. But again, you see, it doesn't take into account the issue of race and colonialism. So it's not quite right to think of the World Bank as being the equivalent of the Marshall Plan. The investment in Europe is also going to benefit investors in the United States. So it's a kind of a mutual thing. It's among equals, right? Everybody benefits. But with the World Bank, you have a hierarchy. So the World Bank, at the top of the hierarchy, really doing what the former colonial power, the powerful countries, need to be done. Because the powerful countries understand the need to develop other countries so that those other countries could buy their products. The World Bank is in the interests of its investors. It's just, by the way, countries could benefit also, because investors want countries to develop, because investors want airports, roads, houses, factories, you know, access to raw material, ports. It's in the interest of capital that the rest of the world be developed too.
Peggy was part of a contingent of educated Caribbeans who came together in the 1970s to form a vision of what development of the region could look like. She describes today's situation from the view of what could have been.
It's basically a world economic order that is based on the colonial powers still in charge, still calling the shots, laying down the rules, the conditions under which you can borrow. And what that system has led to, a few things. First of all, quite apart from the climate crisis, which has led directly to that, because it has facilitated extractivism and the kind of economic growth that has really led to the climate crisis. There's no question about that. But it has also led to increasing inequality and the continuation of dependence. It has led to continuation of the same colonial relations that we were supposed to have ended with independence. And it has led to a world order where, you know, the North and the South, the rich and the poor, but not just between countries, but within countries. So in the South, you also have that world order represented in every country. And the thing about climate change and these small countries, we're the most vulnerable, because you're talking about our entire country. And it's not just an economy now. It's not just the destruction of a coastline. It's the entire country. Barbados is so small that the entire island could be washed out, like the Pacific Islands. So it's an economic order that is not designed for us, but is doing enormous harm. And it's an existential crisis. So in the 70s was a time when a lot of the newly independent countries of Africa and the Caribbean were coming into their own and finding membership in the United Nations. They found a voice.
From her earliest experiences, Peggy saw the promise of the United Nations for small island countries. But the tensions of the Cold War raised the stakes for the large nations, who had no qualms about making pawns of the post-colonial nations.
They found a voice, but again, not quite part of it, because in the United Nations, every country has a voice, except with the Security Council, of course. They re-inscribe the hierarchy there with the power. But anyways, the newly independent countries of Africa, the Caribbean, Asia, began calling for a new international economic order, NIEO. That's when I first got involved in working on women's issues for the government of Jamaica. So they had an international platform, and there was a movement, and the movement was speaking with one voice.
On Wings, you're listening to an interview with Dr. Peggy Antrobus, Caribbean feminist elder, about her life and work. This is your host, Suki Wessling of The Babblery.
We actually had a North-South dialogue at the UN. And all this was, by the way, was against the backdrop of the Cold War. So you also had the backdrop was an East-West divide. So against this backdrop, maybe because of the Cold War, these countries had a very strong voice because there was a battle going on between the Soviet Union and the West as to, you know, where would these new voices go? So that was all part of the Cold War and that part of the whole anti-communist thing. And the whole thing about communism and capitalism had nothing to do with us in the South. We got drawn into it. The Grenada Revolution was a victim of that. You know, it's not our struggle. It's not our battle. Our struggle was just to get some justice for our countries, you know. And then in the 70s, we were finding we're up against these structures. So behind that whole call for a new international economic order was actually about trade. It was actually about the relationship between manufactured products, raw material. Because what was happening was that the price of raw materials was being kept artificially low so that the people that manufactured the products would make extraordinary profits. So for them to be profitable, they have to have raw materials as cheap as possible, labor as cheap as possible. So what would happen is that the South would be producing all the raw material, you know, the sugar and the cocoa and the oil and all of that rubber and all of that raw material. And the North would import that raw material and they would manufacture things. We're talking about the days in which, you know, the United States was a big manufacturing country. Germany, huge. You know, and that was the model. Everybody wanted to be a manufacturing country. But the South is being prevented from being like that because, as somebody said to me at Harvard once, and who would buy our stuff? If you produce your own stuff, who would buy our stuff? And that kind of took me aback. I mean, why should our job be to buy American stuff? We were not put on this earth to buy American stuff, surely. We are not here to be consumers, right? Of American products. I wasn't a consumer, I was a citizen. Suki, it's very difficult to control me because I have so much to say, you know? You have to restrain me.
I definitely didn't want to restrain her. I asked Peggy about her current home, Barbados, and how she thinks the young people are doing.
I would say that one of the problems with youth in the Caribbean is there are not a lot of opportunities in the Caribbean for young people. Always, young people have to go overseas. So we have a large diaspora. And it's partly because these islands are just so small and the opportunities are so limited, you know, so they go overseas. But in my day, in my youth, we had something to dream about, you know, which was independence. To me, the problem with young people in the Caribbean today is American culture. We are so exposed to it. You know, they are, through social media, they are so exposed to materialism, to consumerism. I think that's right. There's a whole set of problems because we cannot continue along this road of materialism and consumerism. We can't, you know? I mean, when I was growing up, we still had kerosene lamps and candles and coal pots and no indoor plumbing, you know. So there was a lot of that stuff that was needed. Now people have it and they take it for granted. I remember my son complaining that there was no hot water in the tap when he was an adolescent. And I said, Jared, I didn't know that hot water came out of taps when I was growing up. I didn't even know that. It's so taken for granted now. We didn't have Nike's. Sneakers. Nobody wanted Nike sneakers. We didn't have internet.
Raising children and watching the new young generation has also given Peggy perspective on the blinders installed by her own childhood in a past where racism was not called out.
You know, we used to go to our old movies and watch the old Tarzan movies without realizing that that was part of our brainwashing. We didn't know. I did a course once, a weekend once on institutionalized racism, and for the first time realized that the things that I grew up with that seemed very benign to me were not so benign after all. I mean, I grew up with Tarzan movies. I didn't know what they represented and what function they were supposed to play. I grew up singing the songs of Stephen Foster, way down upon the Swanee River, along, you know, all the nostalgia for the South. I did all that, not knowing what I was talking about, not knowing what it represented. You know, oh, darkies, how my heart growed weary. Here am I, an African descent. Oh, darkies, how my heart grows weary, longing for the old days at home. All that good old stuff down on the plantation, how I'm longing for it now that I'm lost in New York ghetto. But in the Caribbean, I mean, I grew up really believing I was such a good colonial. I mean, I really believed that what was best for Britain was best for us. I mean, my parents worked for the colonial office. My education was entirely British. I knew everything about the British Isles and I knew nothing about the Caribbean, nothing. So my geography was British geography. My history was British history. When I was growing up, my curriculum was all set by Oxford and Cambridge. You know, and it's the same curriculum. The children in Nigeria, South Africa, Australia, India, Pakistan. I have friends from India. We kind of laugh about it. I honestly believed that what was best for Britain was best for us. I believed in the mother country. Going to England for a start, you find out right away. That's no mother country. They don't regard you as their favorite children. I never knew about racism until I went to England. I didn't know I was black. I had a clue. I didn't know anything about slavery growing up in the Caribbean. Can you believe it? I had to find out. I didn't know I was black growing up. I had to find out. And that's one of the reasons why I feel so fortunate, you know, is as an adult, you can deal with those things when you're an adult. But as a child growing up, being made to feel that there's something wrong with something, you're somehow less, and all the messages are telling you that.
The second Trump administration, Peggy says, is starting a whole new chapter in Caribbean-American relations.
The Caribbean has always had deep roots in America. Our diaspora is there. I mean, we all have family there. I have a daughter, grandchildren, all have family there. So we're so deeply connected. But I don't think that I wouldn't go. Personally, I'm not even going to go and see my grandchildren right now. If I were younger, I would not be going there now. Least of all to migrate. You'd have to be mad to even think about it. I think you have to take a very long view right now. You have to believe in the resilience of nature. Some people, I'm one of them, who thinks that the only thing that will stop the madness is the climate, Mother Nature. I honestly believe that the only thing that's going to stop this is Mother Nature. So I'm waiting for some kind of, you know, cataclysm.
I asked Peggy how she thinks we will move forward from here, and she brought it back to where she comes from.
My ancestors went through slavery. They went through the Middle Passage. You know, when you read about that, you wonder how anybody ever survived. How did anybody ever survive that? Well, and now again, I know how they survived. Women. Women's love. That's it. The historians don't write about that. My hope comes from my own history, you know, and my non-attachment to material stuff and my understanding that, you know, the most important things are not things. You know, money is important, but it's not how people survive in the Caribbean. Norman Manley, who is the father of Michael Manley, used to say, the poor survive on the generosity of the poor, not the generosity of the rich. People help each other, you know. And I think about Caribbean history, coming out of slavery, right? Coming off the plantation. They had a market on a Saturday. They helped each other. In the Caribbean, we have this concept of family that goes beyond kinship. We talk about people as aunts and uncles who are our parents' best friends. We have the concept of family, F-A-M-B-L-I, family, you know? And we look out for each other. That's how we survived slavery. And, you know, women would pick up those broken bodies and take care of them. That's the idea, the same idea that poor people kind of, they band together and they guarantee loans for each other. My mother-in-law never worked outside the home, so she never had any cash. But she used to guarantee loans for people. She used to call the hardware merchants and say, so-and-so wants some lumber or some galvanized or some paint. And we use the word trust. We trust her, you know, let her have what she needs. And they would take my mother-in-law's word for it. And those women never reneged on their loan. They never let down my mother-in-law. So I think, again, coming out of slavery, we know in the Caribbean how to manage without cash. I mean, sometimes it's exchange, you know, exchanging things, but sometimes it's based on people's relationships of caring. When I was growing up, I mean, you won't find anybody homeless or starving on the street in the Caribbean. You'd always be able to get a meal somewhere or something. Somebody is going to give you something. And remittances, that's where remittances come in. I mean, one of my real fears about the collapse of the U.S. economy is what will happen to remittances. I mean, there's whole communities in the Caribbean that depend on those remittances. You know, people that go to the United States and work hard and send money home to their family. They do all sorts of menial things. I mean, they're all sort of terrible, terrible work so that they can send money to their children and their families. That's how their families survive. And it's not considered charity, you know? It's your family. And when those people come back to the Caribbean on holiday, they're treated like royalty. And it compensates for being demeaned and treated with contempt in the ghettos, you know? So they come back. I know a man in Miami who's a gardener from Jamaica. Every year he buys a lot of toys and he goes back to Jamaica, to his village, and he's like Santa Claus. It's just wonderful. It's how people survive and thrive.
During our conversation, Peggy Antrobus pointed out that island nation residents are the most vulnerable to climate change. But at the same time, she welcomes Mother Nature as a power that might finally bring some change.
And when we had our last shot of creating the kind of world we wanted before Reagan came and took it all away, our leaders gave it away. They all bought into this nonsense about Washington consensus. It wasn't a consensus. To me, a consensus is something that emerges out of a conversation. So we have a consensus. No, but the U.S. Treasury defined the Washington consensus. And then the discourse about the Washington consensus and the Thatcher picking it up and saying it's the only alternative, you know, it's the only thing. And here we are today. Everybody believes it's the only way to organize an economy. But I think the climate's going to do it. The climate is going to speak ultimately, you know, Mother Nature. Ultimately, Mother Nature is going to take charge. Hold on to part of it. Hold on to part of it. Part of the mother. Remember that we are part of the mother. Hearts up and chasing.
My deepest thanks to Dr. Peggy Antrobus for speaking with me. Her experience includes many decades of work on global women's issues, development, and the economy. She co-founded Dawn, Development Alternatives with Women for a New Era. Find more of our conversation on wings.org. The song Stay Alive by Holly Cook is courtesy of the freemusicarchive.org. I'm Suki Wesslin.
Wings thanks all our supporters and contributors, past and present, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, author of the book The Gift in the Heart of Language, The Maternal Source of Meaning. The Wings Sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
All I can get is static or variations on the central musical rhythm.
I only wish there was some way we could tell it to shut up. It's driving me crazy. And it keeps getting louder.
We have no way of estimating the volume this creature can produce.
The only logical solution is to listen to CJS at 90.1 FM. They broadcast from Burnaby Mountain in British Columbia. Let's tune in now.
What's this? Hey. What's up? Hey. Speak. Can you speak? What's up? Ready? Speak.